Disc 6.
There's a man in New York. He's dedicated his life to the subject of Nazi art looting. He knows the contents of every stolen collection, every transaction, every piece that's been recovered, every piece that's still missing. If anyone knows anything about the collecting habits of Augustus Rolf, it's him. Quietly, Eli, very quietly. My dear Gabriel, I know of no other way. They pulled on their coats, and Levon walked him across the Judenplatz. Does the daughter know any of this?
Not yet.
I don't envy you. I'll call you when I hear something from my friend in New York. In the meantime, go to your hotel and get some rest. You don't look well.
I can't remember the last time I slept.
Levon shook his head and laid his small hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
You've killed again, Gabriel. I can see it in your face. It's the stain of death. Go to your room and wash your face.
You be a good boy and watch your back.
I used to watch yours.
You were the best.
I'll let you in on a little secret, Gabriel. I still am.
And with that, Levon turned and vanished into the crowd on the Judenplatz. Gabriel walked to the little trattoria where he had eaten his last meal with his Leah and Dani. For the first time in 10 years, he stood on the spot where the car had exploded. He looked up and saw the spire of St. Stephen's floating above the rooftops. A wind rose suddenly. Gabriel turned up the collar of his coat. What had he expected? Grief? Rage? Hatred? Much to his surprise, he felt nothing much at all. He turned and walked back to the hotel in the rain. A copy of Depressa had been slipped under the door and lay on the floor in the alcove. Gabriel scooped it up and entered the bedroom. Anna was still asleep. At some point she had removed her clothing, and in the dim light he could see the luminous skin of her shoulder glowing against the bedding. Gabriel dropped the newspaper on the bed next to her. Exhaustion pounced on him. He needed to sleep. But where? On the bed? Next to Anna? Next to the daughter of Augustus Rolf? How much did she know? What secrets did her father keep from her? What secrets had she kept from Gabriel? He thought of the words Julian Isherwood had said to him in London. Assume at all times that she knows more about her father and his collection than she's telling you. Daughters tend to be very protective of their fathers, even when they think their fathers are complete bastards. No, he thought, he would not be sleeping next to Anna Rolf. In the closet, he found an extra blanket and a spare pillow, and he made a crude bed for himself on the floor. It was like lying on a slab of cold marble. He reached up and blindly patted the duvet, searching for the newspaper. Quietly, so as not to wake her, he opened it. On the front page was a story about the murder in Lyon of the Swiss writer Émile Jacobi. Chapter 28. Vienna. It was dusk when Eli Levon telephoned Gabriel's hotel room. Anna stirred, then drifted back into an uneasy sleep. During the afternoon she had kicked away her blankets, and her body lay exposed to the cold air seeping through the half-open window. Gabriel covered her and went downstairs. Levon was sitting in the parlour, drinking coffee. He poured some for Gabriel and handed him the cup.
I saw your friend, Émile Jacobi, on the television today, Levon said. Seems someone walked into his apartment in Lyon and slashed his throat.
I know. What did you hear from New York?
It's believed that between 1941 and 1944, Augustus Rolf acquired a large number of Impressionist and Modern paintings from galleries in Lucerne and Zurich, paintings that a few years before had hung in Jewish-owned galleries and homes in Paris.
What a surprise, Gabriel murmured. A large number? How many?
Unclear.
He purchased them?
Not exactly. It's thought that the paintings acquired by Rolf were part of several large exchanges carried out in Switzerland by agents of Hermann Göring.
Gabriel remembered things Julian Isherwood had told him about the ravenous collecting habits of the Reichsmarschall. Göring had enjoyed unfettered access to the Jeu de Paume, where the confiscated art of France was stored. He had taken possession of hundreds of modern works to use as barter for the old masterworks he preferred.
It's rumored that Rolf was allowed to purchase the paintings for only a nominal sum, Lavon said, something far below their fair value.
So if that were the case, the acquisitions would have been entirely legal under Swiss law. Rolf could say that he purchased them in good faith, and even if the paintings were stolen property, he would be under no legal obligation to return them.
So it would appear. The question we should be asking is this. Why was Augustus Rolf allowed to buy paintings that passed through the hands of Hermann Göring at bargain basement prices?
Does your friend in New York have an answer to that question?
No, but you do.
What are you talking about, Eli?
The photographs and the bank documents you found in his desk. His relationship with Walter Schellenberg. The Rolf family collected for generations. Rolf was well connected. He knew what was going on across the border in France, and he wanted a piece of the action.
And Walter Schellenberg needed some way to compensate his private banker in Zurich.
Indeed, Lavon said. Payment for services rendered.
Gabriel sat back in his chair and closed his eyes.
What next, Gabriel?
It's time to have a conversation I've been dreading.
When Gabriel went back upstairs to the room, Anna was beginning to awaken. He shook her shoulder gently and she sat up with a start, like a child confused by strange surroundings. She asked for the time, and he told her it was early evening. When she was fully conscious, he pulled a chair to the end of the bed and sat down. He left the lights off. He had no wish to see her face. She sat upright, her legs crossed, her shoulders wrapped in bedding. She was staring at him. Even in the darkness, Gabriel could see her eyes locked on him. He told her about the origins of her father's secret collection. He told her the things he had learned from Emil Jacobi, and that the professor had been killed the previous night in his apartment in Lyon. Finally, he told her about the documents he had found in her father's desk, the documents linking him to Hitler's spymaster, Walter Schellenberg. When he was finished, he laid the photographs on the bed and went into the bathroom to give her a moment of privacy. He heard the click of the bedside lamp and saw light seeping beneath the bathroom door. He ran water in the sink and counted slowly in his head. When an appropriate amount of time had passed, he went back into the bedroom. He found her coiled into a ball, her body silently convulsing, her hand clutching the photograph of her father, admiring the view at Berchtesgaden with Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. Gabriel pulled it from her grasp before she could destroy it. Then he placed his hand on her head and stroked her hair. Anna's weeping finally became audible. She choked and began to cough, a heavy smoker's cough that left her gasping for breath. Finally, she looked up at Gabriel.
If my mother ever saw that picture...
She hesitated, her mouth open, tears streaming down her cheeks.
She would have...
But Gabriel pressed the palm of his hand against her lips before she could utter the words. He didn't want her to say the rest. There was no need. If her mother had seen that picture, she would have killed herself, he thought. she would have dug her own grave, put a gun into her mouth, and killed herself. This time, it was Anna's turn to retreat into the bathroom. When she returned, she was calm, but her eyes were raw, and her skin was without color. She sat at the end of the bed with the photographs and documents in her hand. "What's this?" "It looks like a list of numbered accounts."
"Whose numbered accounts?"
"The names are German. We can only guess at who they really are." She studied the list carefully, brow furrowed.
"My mother was born on Christmas Day, 1933. Did I ever tell you that?"
"Your mother's birth date has never come up between us, Anna. Why is it relevant now?" She handed him the list.
"Look at the last name on the list."
Gabriel took it from her. His eyes settled on the final name and number. Alois Ritter. 25123312 6. He looked up.
"So, isn't it interesting that a man with the same initials as my father has an account number in which the first 6 digits match my mother's birthday?"
Gabriel looked at the list again. Alois Ritter. A. R. 25-12-33. Christmas Day, 1933. He lowered the paper and looked at Anna.
"What about the last 3 numbers? Do they mean anything to you?"
"I'm afraid they don't." Gabriel looked at the numbers and closed his eyes. 1, 2, 6. Somewhere, at some point, he was certain he had seen them in connection with this case. He had been cursed with a flawless memory. He never forgot anything. The brushstrokes he had used to heal the painting of St. Stephen in the cathedral, the tune that had been playing on the radio the night he had fled the Niederdorf after killing Ali Hamidi, the smell of olives on Leah's breath when he had kissed her goodbye for the last time. Then, after a moment, the place where he had seen the number 1, 2, 6. Anna carried a picture of her brother, always. It was the last photo ever taken of him, leading a stage of the tour of Switzerland the afternoon of his death. Gabriel had seen the same photograph in the desk of Augustus Rolf. He looked at the number attached to the frame of the bicycle and the back of his jersey. 1, 2, 6. Anna said,
"It looks like we're going back to Zurich."
"We have to do something about your passport and your appearance."
"What's wrong with my passport?"
"It has your name in it."
"And my appearance?"
"Absolutely nothing. That's the problem." He picked up the telephone and dialed. The girl Hannah Landau came to the hotel room at 10 o'clock that night. She wore bangles on her wrists and smelt of jasmine. The case hanging from her arm was not unlike the one Gabriel used for his paintbrushes and pigments. She spoke to Gabriel for a moment, then drew Anna into the bathroom by the hand and closed the door. 1 hour later, Anna emerged. Her shoulder-length blonde hair had been cropped short and dyed black. Her green eyes had been turned blue by cosmetic lenses. The transformation was truly remarkable. It was as though she were another woman.
"Do you approve?"
Hannah Landau asked.
"Take the picture."
The Israeli girl snapped a half-dozen photographs of Anna with a Polaroid camera and laid the prints on the bed for Gabriel to see. When they had finished developing, Gabriel said,
"That one."
Hannah shook her head.
"No, I think that one."
She snatched up the picture without waiting for Gabriel's approval and returned to the bathroom. Anna sat down at the vanity and spent a long time examining her appearance in the mirror. 20 minutes later, Hannah came out. She showed her work to Gabriel, then walked across the room and dropped it on the vanity in front of Anna.
"Congratulations, Miss Rolf. You are now a citizen of Austria."
Chapter 29. Zurich. Halfway between the Hauptbahnhof and Zurichsee, is the epicenter of Swiss banking, the Paradeplatz. The twin headquarters of Credit Suisse and the Union Bank of Switzerland glare at each other like prize fighters over the broad expanse of grey brick. They are the two giants of Swiss banking and among the most powerful in the world. In their shadow, up and down the length of the Bahnhofstrasse, are other big banks and influential financial institutions, their locations clearly marked by bright signs and polished glass doors. But scattered in the quiet side streets and alleys between the Bahnhofstrasse and Seal River are the banks few people notice. They are the private chapels of Swiss banking, places where men can worship or confess their sins in absolute secrecy. Swiss law forbids these banks from soliciting for deposits. They are free to call themselves banks if they wish, but they are not required to do so. Difficult to locate, easy to miss, they are tucked inside modern office blocks or in the rooms of centuries-old townhouses. Some employ several dozen workers, some only a handful. They are private banks in every sense of the word. This is where, the following morning, Gabriel and Anna Rolf began their search. She threaded her arm through Gabriel's and pulled him along the Bahnhofstrasse. This was her town. She was in charge now. Gabriel watched the passing faces for signs of recognition. If Anna was going to be noticed anywhere in the world, it would be here. No one gave her a second look. Hannah Landau's rapid makeover seemed to be working. "Where do we start?" Gabriel asked. "Like most Swiss bankers, my father maintained professional accounts in other Swiss banks."
"Correspondent accounts?"
"Exactly. We'll start with the ones where I know he'd done business in the past."
"What if the account isn't in Zurich? What if it's in Geneva?"
"My father was a Züricher through and through. He'd never even consider handing over his money or his possessions to a Frenchman in Geneva."
"Even if we find the account, there's no guarantee we're going to have access to it."
"That's true. The bankers make the accounts only as secret as the account holder wants. We may be allowed access with just a number. We may need a password. We might be shown the door. But it's worth a try, isn't it? Let's start over there."
Without warning, she changed direction, darting across the Bahnhofstrasse in front of a speeding tram, pulling Gabriel by the hand. Then she led him into a smaller street, the Berngasse, and stopped before a simple doorway. Above the doorway was a security camera, and mounted on the stone wall next to it was a brass plaque, so small it was nearly unnoticeable. Hoffmann and Weck, Berngasse 43. She pressed the bell and waited to be admitted. 5 minutes later they were back on the street again, walking to the next bank on Anna's list. There the performance took slightly longer, 7 minutes by Gabriel's estimate, but the result was the same. Back on the street, empty-handed. And on it went. Each performance was a slight variation of the same theme. After enduring a moment of scrutiny through the security camera, they would be admitted into a vestibule, where an officer of the bank would greet them cautiously. Anna did all the talking, conducting each encounter in brisk but polite Zürichdeutsch. Finally, they would be escorted to the sacristy, the hallowed inner office, where the secret records were kept, and seated in chairs before the banker's desk. After a few meaningless pleasantries, there would be a discreet clearing of the throat, a polite reminder that time was being wasted, and on the Bahnhofstrasse, time was certainly money. Then Anna would say, "I'd like access to the account of Herr Alois Ritter." A pause, a few taps on a computer keyboard, a long gaze into a glowing monitor. "I'm sorry, but it appears we have no account in the name of Alois Ritter."
"Are you certain?"
"Yes, quite certain."
"Thank you. I apologize for wasting your valuable time."
"Not at all. Take our card. Perhaps you'll require our services in the future."
"You're very kind."
After visiting 11 banks, they had coffee in a small restaurant called Café Brioche. Gabriel was getting nervous. They had been traipsing around the Bahnhofstrasse for nearly 2 hours.
They could not go unnoticed for long. The next stop was Becker and Pool, where they were greeted by Herr Becker himself. He was starched and fussy and very bald. His office was drab and as sterile as an operating room. As he stared into his computer monitor, Gabriel could see the ghostly reflections of names and numbers scrolling across the polished lenses of his rimless spectacles. After a moment of quiet contemplation, he looked up and said, "Account number, please." Anna recited it from memory. 25, 12, 33, 126. Becker tapped the keyboard. "Password?" Gabriel felt his chest tighten. He looked up and noticed Herr Becker eyeing him over the computer terminal. Anna cleared her throat gently and said, "Adagio." "Follow me, please." The little banker escorted them from his office to a high-ceilinged conference room with paneled walls and a rectangular smoked-glass table.
"Your privacy can be better assured this way," he said. "Please make yourself comfortable. I'll bring you the contents of the account in a few moments."
When Becker returned, he was carrying a metal safe deposit box.
"According to the covenant on the account, anyone who presents the proper account number and password is permitted access to the deposit boxes," Becker said, as he slid the box onto the tabletop. "I possess all the keys."
"I understand," said Anna. Becker whistled tunelessly as he removed a heavy ring of keys from his pocket and selected the appropriate one. When he found it, he held it aloft to check the engraving, then inserted it into the lock and lifted the lid. Instantly, the air smelled of decaying paper. Becker stepped back to a respectful distance.
"There is a second safe deposit box. I'm afraid it's rather large. Do you wish to see that one as well?"
Gabriel and Anna looked at each other across the table and at the same time said,
"Yes."
Gabriel waited for Becker to leave the room before lifting the lid. There were 16 in all, neatly rolled, shrouded in protective coverings. Monet, Picasso, Degas, Van Gogh, Manet, Toulouse-Lautrec, Renoir, Bonnard, Cézanne, a stunning nude in repose by Vuillard. Even Gabriel, a man used to working with priceless art, was overwhelmed by the sheer volume of it. How many people had searched for these very pieces, how many years, how many tears had been shed over their loss. And here they were, locked in a safe deposit box, in a vault beneath the Bahnhofstrasse. How fitting, how perfectly logical. Anna resumed her search of the smaller box. She lifted the lid and began removing the contents. First came the cash. Swiss francs, French francs, dollars, pounds, marks, which she handled with the ease of someone used to money. Next came an accordion file folder filled with documents, and finally a stack of letters bound by a pale blue elastic band. She loosened the band, laid it on the table, and began flipping through the stack of envelopes with her long, agile fingers. Forefinger, middle finger, forefinger, middle finger, pause. Forefinger, middle finger, pause. She pulled one envelope from the stack, turned it over in her hand, tested the flap to make certain it was still sealed, then held it up for Gabriel to see.
"You might be interested in this."
"What is it?"
"I don't know," she said, "but it's addressed to you."
It was the personal stationery of a man from another time. Pale grey in colour, A4 in size, Augustus Rolf, centred at the top, no other superfluous information such as a fax number or an email address, only a date, one day before Gabriel arrived in Zurich. The note was rendered in English, handwritten by a man no longer capable of producing legible handwriting. The result was that it might have been written in almost any language, using any alphabet. With Anna looking over his shoulder, Gabriel managed to decipher the text.
Dear Gabriel, I hope you do not find it presumptuous that I have chosen to address you by your real name, but I have known your true identity for some time, and have been an admirer of your work, both as an art restorer and as a guardian of your people. When one is a Swiss banker, one hears things. If you are reading this note, it certainly means that I am dead. It also means that you have probably uncovered a great deal of information about my life, information that I had hoped to convey to you personally. I will attempt to do that now, posthumously. As you know by now, you were not brought to my villa in Zurich to clean my Raphael. I made contact with your service for one reason. I wanted you to take possession of my second collection, the secret collection in the underground chamber of my villa, which, I trust, you are aware of, and return the works to their rightful owners. If the rightful owners could not be located, it was my wish that the paintings be hung in museums in Israel. I turned to your service because I preferred that the matter be handled quietly, so as not to bring additional shame on my family or my country. The paintings were acquired with a veneer of legality, but quite unjustly. When I purchased them, I was aware that they had been confiscated from the collection of Jewish dealers and collectors in France. Gazing upon them has given me untold hours of pleasure over the years, but, like a man who lies with a woman not his own, I have been left with the ache of guilt. It was my wish to return those paintings before my death, to atone for my misdeeds in this life before moving on to the next. Ironically, I found inspiration in the foundation of your religion. On Yom Kippur, it is not enough for one to feel sorry for the foul deeds one has done. To achieve forgiveness, one must go to the injured parties and make amends. I found particular relevance in Isaiah. A sinner asks God, "Why, when we fasted, did you not see? When we starved our bodies, did you pay no heed?" And God replies, "Because on your fast day you see to your business and oppress all your laborers, because you fast in strife and contention, and you strike with a wicked fist." My greed during the war was as boundless as my guilt is now. There are 16 paintings in this bank. They represent the rest of my secret collection. Please do not live without them. There are people in Switzerland who want the past to remain exactly where it is, entombed in the bank vaults of the Bahnhofstrasse, and they will stop at nothing to achieve that end. They think of themselves as patriots, as guardians of the Swiss ideal of neutrality and fierce independence. They are intensely hostile to outsiders, especially those that they regard as a threat to their survival. Once I considered these men my friends, another of my many mistakes. Unfortunately, they became aware of my plans to relinquish the collection. They sent a man from the security services to frighten me. It is because of his visit that I am writing this letter. It is because of his masters that I am now dead. One final thing. If you are in contact with my daughter, Anna, please take care that no harm comes to her. She has suffered enough because of my folly. Sincerely, Augustus Wolf. The little banker was waiting outside in the anteroom. Gabriel signaled him through the glass door and he entered the viewing room. "May I help you?" "When was the last time this account was accessed?"
"I'm sorry, sir, but that information is privileged."
Anna said, "We need to remove a few items. Would you happen to have a bag of any kind?"
Regrettably, we do not. We're a bank, not a department store. May we have the box? I'm afraid there will be a fee. That's fine. A rather substantial fee.
Anna pointed to the stack of cash on the tabletop.
Do you have a currency preference?
Chapter 30. Zurich. In a bakery, 5 miles north of Zurich, Gabriel made a telephone call and bought a Dinkelbrot. When he returned to the car, he found Anna reading the letter her father had written the night before his murder. Her hands were shaking. Gabriel started the engine and pulled back onto the motorway. Anna folded the letter, slipped it back into the envelope, then placed the envelope in the safe deposit box. The box containing the paintings lay on the back seat. Gabriel switched on the wipers. Anna leaned her head against the window and watched the water streaking across the glass.
Who did you call?
We're going to need some help getting out of the country.
Why? Who's going to stop us?
The same people who killed your father, and Müller, and Emil Jacobi.
How will they find us?
You entered the country on your own passport last night. Then you rented this car in your own name. It's a small town. We should act on the assumption that they know we're in the country, and that someone saw us on the Bahnhofstrasse, despite your new appearance.
Who's they, Gabriel?
He thought of Rolf's letter.
There are people in Switzerland who want the past to remain exactly where it is, entombed in the bank vaults of the Bahnhofstrasse, and they will stop at nothing to achieve that end. What the hell was he trying to say? People in Switzerland.
Rolf knew exactly who they were, but even in death, the secretive old Swiss banker couldn't reveal too much. Still, the clues and the circumstantial evidence were there. Through the use of conjecture and educated guesses, Gabriel might be able to fill in the pieces the old man had left out. Instinctively, he approached the problem as though it were a painting in need of restoration, a painting that, unfortunately, had suffered significant losses over the centuries. He thought of a Tintoretto he had once restored, a version of the Baptism of Christ that the Venetian master had painted for a private chapel. It was Gabriel's first job after the bombing in Vienna, and he had deliberately sought out something difficult in which to lose himself. The Tintoretto was just that. Vast portions of the original painting had been lost over the centuries. Indeed, there were more blank spots on the canvas than those covered with pigment. Gabriel effectively had to repaint the entire work, incorporating the small patches of the original. Perhaps he could do the same with this case, repaint the entire story around the few patches of fact that were known to him. Perhaps it went something like this. Augustus Rolf, a prominent Zurich banker, decides to give up his collection of Impressionist paintings, a collection he knows contains works confiscated from Jews in France. In keeping with his character, Rolf wishes to conduct this transaction quietly. So he contacts Israeli intelligence and asks for a representative to be sent to Zurich. Shamron suggests Gabriel meet with Rolf at his villa, using the restoration of the Raphael as cover for the visit. Unfortunately, they became aware of my plans to relinquish the collection. Somewhere along the line, Rolf makes a mistake, and his plan to hand over the paintings to Israel is discovered by someone who wishes to stand in his way. They think of themselves as patriots, as guardians of the Swiss ideal of neutrality and independence. They are intensely hostile to outsiders, especially those that they regard as threats to their survival. Who would feel threatened by the prospect of a Swiss banker handing over an ill-gotten collection of paintings to Israel? Other Swiss bankers with similar collections? Gabriel tried to look at it from their perspective, the perspective of those guardians of the Swiss ideal of neutrality and fierce independence. What would have happened if it became public knowledge that Augustus Rolf possessed so many paintings thought to have been lost forever? The outcry would have been deafening. the world's Jewish organizations would have descended on the Bahnhofstrasse, demanding that the bank vaults be opened. Nothing short of a nationwide systematic search would have been acceptable. If you were one of these so-called guardians of the Swiss ideal, it might have been easier to kill a man and steal his collection than face uncomfortable new questions about the past. They sent a man from the security services to frighten me. Gabriel thought of the silk-cut cigarettes he had found in the ashtray on the desk in Rolf's study. A man from the security services. Gerhard Peterson. They meet in the quiet of Rolf's Zurich study and discuss the situation like reasonable Swiss gentlemen, Rolf smoking his Benson and Hedges, Peterson his silk cuts. "Why hand over the paintings now, Herr Rolf? So many years have gone by. There's nothing that can be done now to change the past." But Rolf doesn't budge, so Peterson arranges with Werner Müller to steal the paintings. Rolf knows that Gabriel is coming the next day, but he's concerned enough to write a letter and leave it in his secret account. He tries to throw off a false trail. Using a telephone he knows is tapped, he makes an appointment to be in Geneva the next morning. Then he makes arrangements for Gabriel to let himself into the villa, and he waits. But at 3 a.m., the security system at the villa suddenly goes down. Peterson's team enters the house. Rolf is killed. The paintings are taken. 6 hours later, Gabriel arrives at the villa and discovers Rolf's body. During the interrogation, Peterson realizes how the old man planned to surrender his collection. He also realizes that Rolf's plan had progressed further than he ever imagined. He releases Gabriel, warns him never to set foot on Swiss soil again, and puts him under surveillance. Perhaps he places Anna under surveillance too. When Gabriel begins his investigation, Peterson knows it. He launches a cleanup operation. Werner Müller is killed in Paris and his gallery destroyed. Gabriel is seen meeting with Émile Jacobi in Lyon. And 3 days later, Jacobi is murdered. Anna tore the end off the loaf of Dinkelbrot. "Who's they?" she repeated. Gabriel wondered how long he had been silent, how many miles he had driven. "I'm not sure," he said, "but perhaps it went something like this." "Do you really think it's possible, Gabriel?"
"Actually, it's the only logical explanation."
"My God, I think I'm going to be sick. I want to get out of this country."
"So do I."
"So if your theory is correct, there's still one more question to be answered."
"What's that?"
"Where are the paintings now?"
"The same place they've always been."
"Where, Gabriel?"
"Here, in Switzerland."
Chapter 31. Bargen, Switzerland. 3 miles from the German border, at the end of a narrow valley dotted with logging villages, stands drab little Bargen, famous in Switzerland if for no other reason than that it is the northernmost town in the country. Just off the motorway is a gas station and a market with a gravel parking lot. Gabriel shut down the car engine, and there they waited in the steel afternoon light.
"How long before they get here?"
"I don't know."
"I have to pee."
"You have to hold it."
"I always wondered how I would react in a situation like this, and now I have my answer. Faced with danger, a life-and-death situation, I'm overcome by an uncontrollable need to urinate."
"You have incredible powers of concentration. Use them."
"Is that what you would do?"
"I never urinate." She swatted his arm gently so as not to hurt his damaged hand.
"I heard you in the bathroom in Vienna. I heard you throwing up. You act as though nothing bothers you. But you're human after all, Gabriel Allon."
"Why don't you smoke a cigarette? Maybe that will help you think of something else."
"How did it feel to kill those men in my father's house?"
Gabriel thought of Eli Lavon. "I didn't have much time to consider the morality or the consequences of my actions. If I hadn't killed them, they would have killed me. I suppose it's possible they were the ones who killed my father.
Yes, it's possible.
Then I'm glad you killed them. Is that wrong for me to think that way?
No, it's perfectly natural.
She took his advice and lit a cigarette. So now you know all the dirty secrets of my family. But today I realized that I really don't know a thing about you.
You know more about me than most people do.
I know a little about what you do, but nothing about you.
That's as it should be.
Oh, come on, Gabriel. Are you really as cold and distant as you pretend to be?
I've been told I have a problem with preoccupation.
Ah, that's a start. Tell me something else.
What do you want to know?
You wear a wedding ring. Are you married?
Yes.
Do you live in Israel?
I live in England.
Do you have children?
We had a son, but he was killed by a terrorist's bomb. He looked at her coldly.
Is there anything else you'd like to know about me, Anna? He supposed he did owe her something, after everything she had surrendered about herself and her father. But there was something else. He suddenly found that he actually wanted her to know. And so he told her about a night in Vienna 10 years earlier, when his enemy, a Palestinian terrorist named Tariq al-Hurani, planted a bomb beneath his car. A bomb that was meant to destroy his family, because the Palestinian knew it would hurt Gabriel much more than killing him. It had happened after dinner. Leah had been edgy throughout the meal, because the television above the bar was showing pictures of Scud missiles raining down on Tel Aviv. Leah was a good Israeli girl. She couldn't stand the thought of eating pasta in a pleasant little Italian restaurant in Vienna while her mother was sitting in her flat in Tel Aviv, with packing tape on the windows and a gas mask over her face. After dinner they walked through drifting snow to Gabriel's car. He strapped Dani into his safety seat, then kissed his wife and told her that he would be working late. It was a job for Shamron, an Iraqi intelligence officer who was plotting to kill Jews. This he didn't tell Anna Rolf. When he turned and walked away, the car engine tried to turn over and hesitated, because the bomb Tariq had placed there was drawing its power from the battery. He turned and shouted for Leah to stop, but she must not have heard him, because she turned the key a second time. Some primeval instinct to protect the young made him rush to Dani first, but he was already dead, his body blown to pieces. So he went to Leah and pulled her from the flaming wreckage. She would survive, though it might have been better had she not. Now she lived in a psychiatric hospital in the south of England, afflicted with a combination of post-traumatic stress syndrome and psychotic depression. She had never spoken to Gabriel since that night in Vienna. This he didn't tell Anna Rolf. It must have been difficult for you, being back in Vienna. It was the first time. Where did you meet her?
At school.
Was she an artist, too?
She was much better than I am.
Was she beautiful?
She was very beautiful. Now she has scars.
We all have scars, Gabriel.
Not like Leah.
Why did the Palestinian plant the bomb beneath the car?
Because I killed his brother.
Before she could ask another question, a Volvo truck pulled into the parking lot and flashed its lights. Gabriel started the car and followed it to the edge of a pine grove outside the town. The driver hopped down from the cab and quickly pulled open the rear door. Gabriel and Anna got out of their car, Anna holding the small safe deposit box, Gabriel the one containing the paintings. He paused briefly to hurl the car keys deep into the trees. The container of the truck was filled with office furniture, desks, chairs, bookshelves, file cabinets. The driver said,
"Go to the front of the cabin, lie down on the floor, and cover yourself with those extra freight blankets."
Gabriel went first, clambering over the furniture, the deposit box in his arms. Anna followed. At the front of the cabin, there was just enough room for them to sit with their knees beneath their chins. When Anna was in place, Gabriel covered them both with the blanket. The darkness was absolute. The truck teetered onto the road, and for several minutes they sped along the motorway. Gabriel could feel the tire spray on the undercarriage. Anna began to hum softly.
What are you doing?
I always hum when I'm scared.
I'm not going to let anything happen to you.
You promise?
I promise, he said.
So what were you humming?
The Swan, from The Carnival of Animals by Camille Saint-Saëns.
Will you play it for me sometime?
No, she said.
Why not?
Because I never play for my friends.
10 minutes later, the border. The truck joined a queue of vehicles waiting to make the crossing into Germany. It crept forward a few inches at a time. Accelerate, brake, accelerate, brake. Their heads rolled back and forth like a pair of children's toys. Each touch of the brake produced a deafening screech of protest. Each press of the throttle, another blast of poisonous diesel fumes. Anna leaned her cheek against his shoulder and whispered,
Now I think I'm going to be sick.
Gabriel squeezed her hand. On the other side of the border, another car was waiting, a dark blue Ford Fiesta with Munich registration. Ari Shamron's truck driver dropped them and continued on his synthetic journey to nowhere. Gabriel loaded the safe deposit boxes into the trunk and started driving. The E41 to Stuttgart, the E52 to Karlsruhe, the E35 to Frankfurt. Once during the night he stopped to telephone Tel Aviv on an emergency line, and he spoke briefly with Shamron. At 2 a.m. they arrived in the Dutch market town of Delft, a few miles inland from the coast. Gabriel could drive no farther. His eyes burned, his ears were ringing with exhaustion. In 8 hours a ferry would leave from Hoek van Holland for the English port of Harwich, and Gabriel and Anna would be on it. But for now he needed a bed and a few hours of rest, so they drove through the streets of the old town looking for a hotel. He found one on the Fundelstraat, within sight of the spire of Nieuwkerk. Anna handled the formalities at the front desk, while Gabriel waited in the tiny parlour with the two safe deposit boxes. A moment later, they were escorted up a narrow staircase to an overheated room with a peaked ceiling and a gabled window, which Gabriel immediately opened. He placed the boxes in the closet. Then he pulled off his shoes and stretched out on the bed. Anna slipped into the bathroom, and a moment later Gabriel heard the comforting sound of water splashing against enamel. The cold night air blew through the open window. Scented with the North Sea, it caressed his face. He permitted himself to close his eyes. A few minutes later, Anna came out of the bathroom. A burst of light announced her arrival. Then she reached out and threw the wall switch, and the room was in darkness again, except for the weak glow of street lamps seeping through the window.
Are you awake?
No.
Aren't you going to sleep on the floor the way you did in Vienna?
I can't move.
She lifted the blanket and crawled into bed next to him. Gabriel said,
How did you know the password was adagio?
Albinoni's adagio was one of the first pieces I learned to play. For some reason it remained my father's favorite.
Her lighter flared in the darkness.
My father wanted forgiveness for his sins. He wanted absolution. He was willing to turn to you for that, but not to me.
Why didn't my father ask me for forgiveness?
He probably didn't think you'd give it to him.
It sounds as though you speak from experience. Has your wife ever forgiven you?
No, I don't think she has.
And what about you?
Have ever you forgiven yourself?
I wouldn't call it forgiveness.
What would you call it?
Accommodation. I've reached accommodation with myself.
My father died without absolution. He probably deserved that. But I want to finish what he set out to do. I want to get those paintings back and send them to Israel.
So do I.
How?
Go to sleep, Anna.
Which she did. Gabriel lay awake, waiting for the dawn, listening to the gulls on the canal and the steady rhythm of Anna's breathing. No demons tonight, no nightmares, the guiltless sleep of a child. Gabriel did not join her. He wasn't ready to sleep yet. When the paintings were locked away in Julian Isherwood's vault, then he would sleep. Part 3. Chapter 32. Nidwalden, Switzerland. On the eve of the Second World War, General Henri Guisson, the commander-in-chief of Switzerland's armed forces, announced a desperate plan to deal with an invasion by the overwhelmingly superior forces of Nazi Germany. If the Germans come, Guisson said, the Swiss army would withdraw to the natural fortress of the Alpine Redoubt and blow up the tunnels, and there they would fight in the deep valleys and on the high mountain ice fields to the last man. It had not come to that, of course. Hitler realized early in the war that a neutral Switzerland would be more valuable to him than a Switzerland in chains and under occupation. Still, the general's heroic strategy for dealing with the threat of invasion lives on in the imagination of the Swiss. Indeed, it was on Gerhard Peterson's mind the following afternoon as he skirted Lucerne and the Alps loomed before him, shrouded in cloud. Peterson could feel his heart beat faster as he pressed the accelerator, and his big Mercedes roared up the first mountain pass. Peterson came from inner Switzerland, and he could trace his lineage back to the tribesmen of the forest cantons. He took a certain comfort in the knowledge that people with his blood had roamed these mountain valleys at the same time a young man called Jesus of Nazareth was stirring up trouble at the other end of the Roman Empire. He became uneasy whenever he ventured too far from the security of his Alpine redoubt. He remembered an official visit to Russia he had made a few years earlier. The limitless quality of the countryside had played havoc with his senses. In his Moscow hotel room, he had suffered his first and only bout of insomnia. When he returned home, he went straight to his country house and spent a day hiking along the mountain trails above Lake Lucerne. That night, he slept. But his sudden trip into the Alps that afternoon had nothing to do with pleasure. It had been precipitated by two pieces of bad news. The first was the discovery of an abandoned Audi A8 on a road near the town of Bargen, a few miles from the German border. A check of the registration revealed that the car had been rented the previous evening in Zurich by Anna Rolf. The second was a report from an informant on the Bahnhofstrasse. The affair was spinning out of control. Peterson could feel it slipping away. It began to snow, big, downy flakes that turned the afternoon to white. Peterson switched on his amber fog lamps and kept his foot down. 1 hour later, he was rolling through the town of Stanz. By the time he reached the gates of the Gessler estate, 3 inches of new snow covered the ground. As he slipped the car into park, a pair of Gessler's security men appeared, dressed in dark blue ski jackets and woolen caps. A moment later, the formalities of identification and scrutiny behind him, Peterson was rolling up the drive toward Gessler's chateau. There, another man waited, tossing bits of raw meat to a ravenous Alsatian bitch. On the shores of Lake Lucerne, not far from Otto Gessler's mountain home, is the legendary birthplace of the Swiss Confederation. In 1291, the leaders of the three so-called forest cantons, Uri, Schwyz, and Unterwalden, are said to have gathered in the Rütli Meadow and formed a defensive alliance against anyone who may plot evil against their persons or goods. The event is sacred to the Swiss. A mural of the Rütli Meadow adorns the wall of the Swiss National Council chamber, and each August the meeting on the meadow is remembered with a national day of celebration. 700 years later, a similar defensive alliance was formed by a group of the country's richest and most powerful private bankers and industrialists. In 1291, the enemy had been an outsider, the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf I of the Habsburg dynasty, who was trying to assert his feudal rights in Switzerland. Today, once again, the enemies were outsiders, but now they were scattered and more numerous. They were the Jews who were trying to pry open the bank vaults of Switzerland to look for money and whatever else they could lay their hands on. They were the governments, demanding that Switzerland pay billions of dollars for accepting Nazi gold during the Second World War, and the journalists and historians who were trying to paint the Swiss as willing allies of Germany, Hitler's money men and arms suppliers who prolonged the war at the cost of millions of lives, and the reformers inside Switzerland who were demanding an end to the sacred laws of banking secrecy. This new alliance took its inspiration from the fiercely independent forest dwellers who gathered along Lake Lucerne in 1291. Like their ancestors, they swore to fight anyone who may plot evil against their persons or goods. They saw the events raging beyond their Alpine redoubt as a gathering storm that could wipe away the institutions that had given Switzerland, a tiny, landlocked country with few natural resources, the second highest standard of living in the world. They called themselves the Council of Rutli, and their leader was Otto Gessler. Peterson had expected to be shown, as usual, to Otto Gessler's makeshift television studio. Instead, the guard escorted him along a lamplit footpath to a single-level wing of the chateau. Passing through an unusually heavy set of French doors, Peterson was greeted by a sweltering tropical heat and an opaque cloud of vapor that reeked of chlorine. Ornate lamps glowed through the mist like storm lanterns, and turquoise water made wave-like patterns on the soaring, open-beamed ceiling. The room was quiet, except for the ripple of Otto Gessler's laborious crawl. Peterson removed his overcoat and scarf and waited for Gessler to complete his lap. The snow that had collected on his leather city loafers quickly melted, soaking his socks.
Gerhard, a pause for air, another stroke. Is that you?
Yes, Herr Gessler.
I hope the snow didn't make your drive too difficult.
Not at all, Herr Gessler. Peterson hoped the old man would take a break, otherwise they were going to be at it all night. A bodyguard appeared at the edge of the pool, then receded behind a veil of mist.
You wished to speak to me about the Rolf case, Gerhard?
Yes, Herr Gessler, I'm afraid we may have a problem.
I'm listening.
For the next 10 minutes, Peterson brought Gessler up to date on the case. Gessler swam while Peterson spoke. Splash, silence, splash, silence.
What conclusion do you draw from these developments?
That they know more about what happened to Augustus Rolf and the collection than we would wish.
An obstinate people, don't you agree, Gerhard?
The Jews?
Never can seem to leave well enough alone, always looking for trouble. I won't be beaten by them, Gerhard.
No, of course not, Herr Gessler. Through the curtain of mist, Peterson glimpsed Gessler rising slowly up the steps of the shallow end of the pool, a pale figure, shockingly frail. A bodyguard covered his shoulders in a toweling robe. Then the curtain of mist closed once more and Gessler was gone.
"She needs to be eliminated," came the dry, disembodied voice. "So does the Israeli."
Peterson frowned.
"There will be consequences. Anna Rolf is a national treasure. If she is murdered so soon after her father, there are bound to be uncomfortable questions, especially in the press. You may rest assured that there will be no outpouring of national grief if Anna Rolf is killed. She refuses even to live in Switzerland, and she's almost done herself in any number of times. And as for the press, they can ask all the questions they want, without facts. Their stories will read like conspiratorial gossip. I only care whether the authorities ask questions. And that's what we pay you for, Gerhard, to make certain the authorities don't ask questions.
I should also warn you that the Israeli Secret Service does not play by the usual rules. If we target one of their agents for assassination, they'll come after us.
I'm not afraid of the Jews, Gerhard, and you shouldn't be either. Contact Anton Ossati right away, I'll move some additional funds into your operational account, as well as something extra into your personal account. Consider it an incentive to make certain that this affair is resolved quickly and quietly.
That's not necessary, Herr Gessler.
I know it's not necessary, but you've earned it.
Peterson hastily changed the subject. He didn't like to think about the money too much. It made him feel like a whore.
I really should be getting back to Zurich, Herr Gessler. The weather.
You're welcome to spend the night here.
No, I really should be getting back.
Suit yourself, Gerhard.
May I ask you a question, Herr Gessler?
Certainly.
Did you know Herr Rolf?
Yes, I knew him well. He and I were quite close once. In fact, I was there the morning his wife committed suicide. She dug her own grave and shot herself. It was young Anna who discovered the body. A terrible thing. Herr Rolf's death was unfortunate but necessary.
It wasn't personal. It was business.
You do understand the difference, don't you, Gerhard?
Chapter 33. London. Julian Isherwood was seated at his desk, leafing through a stack of paperwork, when he heard the sound of a delivery truck rumbling across the bricks of Mason's Yard. He walked to his window and peered out. A man in blue coveralls was climbing out the front passenger side and making his way to the door. A moment later came the howl of the buzzer.
"Irina, did you schedule any deliveries for today?"
"No, Mr. Isherwood."
"Oh, Christ," thought Isherwood. "Not again."
"Irina?"
"Yes, Mr. Isherwood."
"I'm feeling a bit hungry, Petal. Would you be a love and bring me a panini from that marvellous shop in Piccadilly?"
"I'd like nothing better, Mr. Isherwood. May I perform any other meaningless and degrading tasks for you?"
"No need to be snotty, Irina. Cup of tea as well, and take your time."
There was something about the man in blue coveralls that reminded Isherwood of the fellow who had searched his house for termites. He wore rubber-soled shoes and worked with the quiet efficiency of a night nurse. In one hand was a device about the size of a cigar box with meters and dials. In the other was a long wand, like a fly-swatter. He began in the basement storerooms, then moved to Irina's office, then Isherwood's, then the exposition room. Lastly, he tore apart the telephones, the computers, and the fax machine. After 45 minutes, he returned to Isherwood's office and laid two tiny objects on the desk.
"You had bugs," he said. "Now they're dead."
"Who in God's name put them in here?"
"That's not my job. I'm just the exterminator." He smiled. "There's someone downstairs who'd like a word with you."
Isherwood led the way through the cluttered storerooms to the loading bay. He opened the outer door, and the delivery truck pulled inside.
"Close the door," said the man in blue coveralls.
Isherwood did as he was told. The man opened the back door of the truck, and a cloud of dense smoke billowed forth. Crouched in the back, a picture of misery, was Ari Shamron. The man in the Rover sedan had moved from German Street to King Street, which was still well within the 1 mile range of the transmitters he had placed in the gallery, but it had been some time since he had heard any sound at all. Indeed, the last thing he had monitored was the art dealer asking his secretary to get him lunch. It had struck him as odd, since the dealer had eaten lunch out every day since the man had been watching him. So odd, in fact, that he had made a notation of the time in his logbook. 45 minutes after that, a burst of raw static came over his car radio. Someone had just found his transmitters. He swore softly and quickly started the car. As he drove away, he picked up his mobile phone and dialed Zurich. The Hoek van Holland to Harwich ferry was delayed several hours by heavy weather in the North Sea, and so it was late afternoon by the time Gabriel and Anna Rolf pulled into Mason's Yard. Gabriel gave two short blasts of the horn, and the door of the loading bay slowly rose. Once inside, he shut down the engine and waited for it to close again before getting out of the car. He removed the large safe deposit box from the back seat and led Anna through the storeroom to the lift. Isherwood was waiting there.
"You must be Anna Rolf. It's an honor to meet you, truly. I had the distinct privilege of seeing you perform an evening of Mendelssohn once. It was a deeply moving experience."
"You're very kind.
Won't you please come inside?"
"Thank you."
"Is he here yet?" Gabriel asked.
"Upstairs in the exposition room.
Let's go."
"What's in the box?"
"In a minute, Julian." Shamron stood in the center of the room, smoking his vile Turkish cigarettes, completely oblivious to the old master canvases surrounding him. Gabriel could see that the old man was wrestling with his memory. A year earlier, in this very room, they had set in motion the final stage of an operation that ended in the death of Tariq al-Hurani. When he saw Anna Rolf enter the room, his face brightened, and he shook her hand warmly. Gabriel placed the safe deposit box on the floor and lifted the lid. Then he removed the first painting, unwrapped it, and laid it on the floor.
"My God!" Isherwood whispered. "A Monet landscape!"
Anna smiled.
"Wait, it gets better."
Gabriel removed the next canvas, a Van Gogh self-portrait, and laid it next to the Monet.
"Oh, good heavens!" murmured Isherwood.
Then came the Degas, then the Bonnard, then the Cézanne and the Renoir, and on it went until the 16 canvases stretched the length of the gallery. Isherwood sat down on the divan, pressed his palms against his temples, and wept. Shamron said,
"Well, that's quite an entrance. The floor is yours, Gabriel."
Anna had heard it all during the drive from Zurich to the German border, so she stepped away and consoled Isherwood while he gazed at the paintings.
This book is continued on Disc 7.